Well, I have other plans for my Martin Luther King Day sermon. Something inspirational on the works of African-American women poets. And then I saw the movie Selma. And while I was watching it, I heard what I needed to speak to you about today. I heard it loud and clear in a voice that I could not ignore. If you haven't seen the Selma movie, I highly recommend it. The movie makers took a little bit of creative license with history, as they often do, but I understand much of it is pretty accurate, and it really shows how it was in the civil rights movement back in the 60s. An extra added bonus is the movie features a pivotal point in Unitarian Universalist history, the tragic death of the Unitarian martyr, the Reverend James Reed, who was beaten by white thugs as he came down from, after he came down from Boston to be part of the protests supporting voting rights for all. But the movie does not focus very much on our history. After all, it's not a story about us. It's somebody else's story. But in some ways, it is kind of our story, and that's why the Selma movie inspired me to preach to you on this topic today. You see, sometime before the death of Reverend Reeve, there was the death of a young man named Jimmie Lee Jackson. Jackson was an active person in the civil rights movement in Alabama. A young man in his mid-20s, he was already a deacon in his local church. He had been trying without success to vote for 4 years. One night in February of 1965, Jackson and several hundred other protesters were taking part in a peaceful march, singing hymns and walking from their church to the local jail where another civil rights leader was being held. The police worried that this group was planning a jailbreak and set upon the crowd with clubs. Many protesters were badly hurt. Jackson was there with his family, and when the violence started to escalate, he tried to get his mother and 82-year-old grandfather into a local cafe for safety. They were followed by state troopers who began to beat Jimmie Lee Jackson. When his mother tried to intervene, they beat her, and when Jimmie tried to protect his mother, the police shot him twice in the abdomen. He ran outside, mortally wounded, and was followed by the police. He died 2 days later in the hospital. The police officer who shot Jackson said he thought Jackson was going to pull a gun, and the officer was not indicted of any wrongdoing at the time. It was said that this event helped inspire that famous march on Selma for voting rights. Now, here's the part that rang in my head. It was at the sermon which Martin Luther King delivered at Jimmy Jackson's funeral. I didn't want to take the movie version verbatim, so I looked online, what would we do without the internet, and I found the Martin Luther King archives, and I found a photo of the handwritten notes he used to deliver that sermon. And so I read here from a draft of the sermon Dr. King gave to the people about the root causes of this young man's death, of Jimmie Lee Jackson's shooting. Dr. King said, "He was murdered by the indifference of every minister of the gospel who has remained silent behind the safe security of stained glass windows. He was murdered by the irrelevancy of a Christian church that remains an echo. He was murdered by the irresponsibility of every politician who has fed his constituents on the stale bread of hatred and the spoiled meat of racism. He was murdered by the timidity of federal government that can spend millions of dollars every day to keep troops in Vietnam and cannot protect the lives of its citizens seeking constitutional rights. He was murdered by the cowardice of every Negro who passively accepts the system of segregation and stands on the sidelines amidst a mighty struggle for justice. So his death says to each of us, black and white alike, we must substitute courage for caution. He says to us we must be concerned not merely with who murdered him, but about the system, the way of life, the philosophy which produced the murder. His death says to us we must work passionately and unrelentingly to make the American dream a reality." Well, those are strong words. And these words beg a question. that I have to answer today, I have to talk about. Did we murder Jimmie Lee Jackson? Did you and I personally murder Jimmie Lee Jackson? Obviously no. I, for one, was just a little girl at the time, and nowhere near Alabama on the night when Jackson was shot. But the bigger question is not about us as individual people who didn't happen to have a gun in our hands that night. I speak to King's indictment of ministers who remained silent behind stained glass windows and irrelevant Christian churches that remained an echo. Now, indeed, we may not claim the title of a Christian church, and our windows are clear, but I think you get my meaning. What was the role of the educated, white, liberal, religious folks in America in this tragedy? There's no quick answer. Did we try to help? Of course we did. Many people, many who may be in this room, wrote letters, participated in protest marches to bring about better relationships in this country. I know of a number of UU ministers who were at that famous march in Selma and faced those dangers and all that hate, including Reverend Bob Shively, who did some consulting here years ago. He was at the March on Selma as a young man. And yes, many, many people saying we shall overcome, as we did today beautifully with Mara, at many a protest march. We voted for progressive candidates often, and I expect that nearly everyone in this room was cautious to avoid racist humor. These are good things to do, and I'm sure we're part of the solution. And in that, we can take some comfort. Yet I'm not sure we white liberals can claim to have a totally clean slate as a community. In many cases, UU congregations were welcoming to folks of all races, but have never had what it takes to truly be diverse and politically progressive religious movements. And while some UU congregations may have held seminars on important matters of justice, others have been reluctant to take a public stand. This could either be because of fear of alienating large communities of white people or alienating those who care more about the rights of the individual to speak only for themselves than caring about the congregational body working to make the world a better place for everyone. I think about King's strong words to the black community who were passively accepting a system of segregation and stood on the sidelines in the midst of a mighty struggle for justice. I don't think white liberal religious people stood on the sidelines, but I also don't think we were true partners in the struggle either. Many of us were more likely to reach out and help the unfortunate, but we're not likely to risk our own position in order to disrupt the larger system. I think here about that huge division that happened in the Unitarian Universalist Association back in the 1960s between the UUs, who wanted to form a black and white group of leaders to reach out and help black people in America, versus the group of UUs who wanted to fund and empower black leaders to do the work their own way in their own communities. This was a huge, huge division within Unitarian Universalists. And I also remember there was a time when people spoke out and said, look, when James Reed was killed, the UU Bay Board descended on Selma. When Jimmie Lee Jackson was killed, well, people were sad, those who knew about it. It wasn't the same. The scars exist from that from those times in the UUA. They truly do. This is part of the scars of our family history. And I'll also say there are scars that exist from some of the anti-racism trainings that many of us attended at some time in history where we felt scolded and ashamed for being born the way we were. I don't need to hate myself for being white. It doesn't help anyone. Shame and scolding are so seldom useful. That doesn't make us better people. I hope that is not what you experience in my sermon today. Yet I do believe we need to pay attention to the ways the system is broken. The system has been very, very broken in the past. In the 1960s, King talked about in his sermon. At Jackson's funeral, a system that supported troops in Vietnam but couldn't support people's safety when they tried to exercise their constitutional rights. The system that was broken that allowed police and local officials to keep black citizens from being able to vote. It was a broken system that allowed police to beat large groups of unarmed protesters, and certainly a broken system that turned a blind eye to the killing of Jimmie Lee Jackson. But the bad news, my friends, is the system is still broken. Yes, things are better. Oh my gosh, things are better. We have a black president. Mixed race couples no longer are looked down on in our society. Many, many people of color have voted unencumbered in every election since they turned 18, even in places like Selma, Alabama. The system is better. The system is still broken. It's easy for me to not notice how broken the system is. I face almost no racism in my life. I pretty much have never been followed around a nice store to make sure I wasn't shoplifting when I walk through Nordstrom or someplace like that. They don't follow me. I've never been afraid to call a police officer when I had a problem. When I've been pulled over for speeding, which has happened more than once. I've never, ever worried about any negative repercussion other than a speeding ticket. Airport security is a hassle, but it's not a difficulty. And when I raised my kids, there were lots and lots and lots of blonde dolls for me to buy so my children could see their world reflected in their play. But many of us read news articles about racial profiling in America. The one that really hits me is the one where Trey and Christian, a 19-year-old black engineering student, he tried to go to Barney's in New York City and buy a $349 belt. And he was detained by the police on suspicion of credit card fraud because the store police could not believe a black man in his teens could afford to purchase such an item, especially not with a credit card. They kept asking him where he got the money. And somehow the fact that a kid in his late teens who had seen the exact same belt on some of his favorite celebrities and used his first paycheck from his on-campus job to go buy him something nice, that just didn't seem to fit. That seemed unbelievable. In contrast, I give you a story from my daughter who lives in St. Louis. Shortly after the Michael Brown killing in Ferguson, there was a very tense protest on her exact street on Shaw Avenue. And the police were out in force and set up a barricade at the end of the road to keep things under control. But when she and a classmate tried to turn the corner to go down that street after class in the evening, they weren't even stopped and questioned. They were just waved through with a smile, not even asked where they were going. Because there are a couple of well-dressed little white girls, clearly not the kind of people who cause a problem. Another story from my daughter. She told this one when she was home at Christmas. One of the nurses she works with told her this experience he'd had. He is an experienced surgical nurse. That is the professional position that will never make you rich, but it pays a pretty good living wage. And this experienced surgical nurse happens to be black. And he had just bought a new car. And he was driving his new car in a white neighborhood in the suburbs, leaving a party at the home of some friends. He was pulled over by the police for no apparent reason, and ask questions like, where did you get that car? Where are you going? Do you know where you are? What are you doing here? Eventually, they let him go without incident. But it's the last, but truly, when is the last time that happened to you? I'm willing to bet for most of us, it has never happened. It has certainly never happened to me. Now, these stories I've told you all involve police, but it happens in other places as well. Black students are much more likely to be expelled from school for behaviors that generally do not result in expulsion for white students. It's been well documented, and this is a huge issue because those who are expelled and suspended not only miss out on a good education, but they're much less likely to be able to get good jobs and much more likely to end up in prison. And this is a huge issue for black parents in the country where they're trying so hard to keep their kids out of prison. You know, black men are incarcerated at a rate of 4,347 inmates per 10,000 U.S. residents. White men are incarcerated at a rate of 678 inmates per 100,000 U.S. residents. That's a big difference. A young kid in school who starts having a little bit of trouble with fights on the playground, for a white family, this is a problem. For a black family, it could be the beginning of a disastrous journey. And remember that many convicted felons can never vote again in an election. The March on Selma, remember, was to support voting rights for black Americans. Well, black people are more likely to be convicted of a felon, and felons are not as likely to be able to vote. So yeah, things are better than they were in 1965, absolutely. But we're not done yet. The system is still broken, and it still needs to be fixed. And here's the thing is, I know the system as it is benefits me and my family. My son once kicked his teacher in the shin in kindergarten. But he was never at risk for prison. And I'm not afraid to call the police if I have to report a crime. I live in what has been called the whitest city in America. Not only that, but I live in a neighborhood right now that has really good schools and rising property values. The mayor of Portland and a U.S. citizen senator live in my neighborhood. And it just happens, so happens to have no people of color within its borders. It's really easy for me to be blind to racial injustices in our society because they don't directly hurt me. If I wanted, I could pretend that it was all just fine out there. Not only that, but a change in the system could easily have a negative impact on my life. To make it more fair for everyone would make it harder for me. But I do know there's injustice, and I do want to change the system. As a Unitarian Universalist, I seek justice, equity, and compassion in human relations as well as the goal of world community with peace and justice for all. These are in our Unitarian Universalist principles. It's how I live my faith and how I want to bloom with service to the wider world. It's often hard to know what to do. How do we change a broken system? How can we help without being patronizing? Well, luckily, the Unitarian Universalist World Magazine had an article on this exact subject, the good old UU World. It was called 5 Ways to Help Support Black Lives Matter. Remember, the Black Lives Matter movement is holding up the dignity and worth of black lives that have been treated as disposable in our society, unworthy of the extra efforts to ensure safety and security, like checking to see if there's really a danger before shooting someone, or assuming black students can't succeed in school. So here's the advice we got, 5 pieces of advice. First bit of advice, learn. Many of us just come to the table with a good intention, but a lot of lack of up-to-date information. We can read books like The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness. Learn what's really going on today, and not just what was going on in the 60s. It's not just the same. The second piece of advice was connect. Many connections with people. Making connections with people in the Black Lives Matter movement is really important. And make connections with people who are in leadership now. The civil rights movement of the 1960s was pretty much run by black male clergy. Jesse Jackson, Martin Luther King. But it's a different generation of leaders now. They don't look the same. They don't talk the same. And a lot of the dialogue is happening on social media. It was asked, what can we do to connect with the Black Lives Matter program if we're not on Twitter? The response was, get on Twitter. I did it yesterday. Still don't know how to use it, but I'm on Twitter now. Among other things it said we could do is support. Protests need food and water. The movement needs money. There's taking up and setting down chairs at big public events. The ministers at the First Unitarian Society in Denver helped host 50 travelers on their way from California to a national convention in Cleveland. Reach out to those with boots on the ground. even if you're not the one marching. Engage. Let folks know that you're a part of this movement. Post about it on your Facebook. Put a sign in your window. Get a banner, a Black Lives Matter banner. One speaker crowded a GA workshop this year when he asked, "The question for Unitarian Universalists is not how many people of color we can get into our pews, but how much damage can we do to white supremacy?" You know, white people are in a good position to influence other white people. Speak out loudly. Last but not least, they recommend that we stay woke. This is a social media term used to describe folks who keep the trouble in the world on our radar, who continue to point out those ever-growing lists of questionable police shootings, who don't let people stop noticing that the system is broken. So, the question Dr. King asked, who killed Jimmie Lee Jackson? Have we let go of comfort and embraced courage? Well, of course, today's question is different. Who killed Trayvon Martin? Who killed Tamar Rice? Did we kill them? One of whom was just a child at the time when the police shot him playing with a gun in the park. Did we shoot him? No, not at all. Did we give resources and speech to support a system that allowed these deaths to happen and go unpunished? I truly hope not. Have we done everything in our power to help change a system that allowed these two innocent kids to be gunned down by people who feared them? I know in this area I am guilty. I am. And you need to answer that question for yourself. Maybe so.